Stop stories, scuffles break out between Dutch police and demonstrators for the second night in a row as anger mounts over the government's COVID-19 measures. The WHO warns that Europe could see 500,000 more COVID-related deaths by March next year unless urgent action is taken. Also in the headlines, the International Organization for Migration says the situation still remains tough for migrants stranded on the border between Belarus and Poland. Welcome to the program. Our top story, scuffles break out in the Netherlands as protests against the government's new coronavirus restrictions continue for the second consecutive night. Latest footage show clashes between police and protesters in The Hague. Thousands of people also took to the streets in the capital, Amsterdam, despite the strong presence of security forces. This follows an outbreak of violence on Friday night in Rotterdam. Three people were injured in the city after police fired shots and water cannons to disperse angry demonstrators. Dozens of people were also arrested. Similar anti-lockdown protests were also held in other European countries on Saturday, including Denmark, Croatia, and Austria.
Tens of thousands take to the streets of the Austrian capital ahead of the nation's fourth general lockdown, affecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike.
This is just one of several rallies taking place across the city just the day after the government announced that vaccinations will become mandatory from February.
Around 2 million of the country's 9 million residents have refused to get vaccinated.
I've not been vaccinated, and I believe this is a bluff on the part of the government. They want to put people under pressure. When vaccination becomes mandatory, I will stay at home. I believe everyone should be able to make their own choice.
I'm here because I'm against the vaccination for everybody. I want to decide myself. It's my body, and so I don't want to tell anyone to me that I have to go to vaccination.
The federal government has blamed the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ, for fueling public anger at a time of national crisis. Police forces confirmed that right-wing extremists, including convicted neo-Nazis, had taken part in the rallies, which remained largely peaceful, despite several instances of clashes and arrests. Austria is now reporting well over 15,000 new infections a day, with the total death toll almost reaching 12,000 people. Health experts say without compulsory vaccinations, the country will only stumble into new lockdowns every 3 or 4 months. Homolezki, Vienna.
Political commentator Lajos Szajdi says European governments have to restrict their people's liberty due to the coronavirus pandemic.
It's a matter of a new variant of the virus that is evolving, and then you have to combine, somehow juggle between liberties and the need of people to go out and go to a restaurant, especially now that Christmas is coming. But then there are other problems, like winter, that because of the cold weather, probably this virus is going to, some people say that if the virus comes from a certain kind of weather, then the opposite kind of weather is going to be, I'm not a biologist, but cold weather might make people stay indoors, stay home, but then, I don't know, that could be like a source of incubation for the virus. In any case, the thing is,
keep the windows closed.
A baseline. People got to get vaccinated. People got to continue with social distancing. People got to use masks. And if you have relaxation, so people are not that careful, I mean, those that haven't vaccinated themselves at all, or they only have one vaccine, that is the problem. And that's the argument in the United States, okay, that they say that there's like 30% people that haven't vaccinated, and the amount of deaths, the increases are in that kind of the population. So it's difficult. It's difficult when you and people want liberty, freedoms, but at the same time, governments have to take this as a public health measure, a matter of life and death. So it's quite difficult. Yes.
The World Health Organization expresses concern over the rising COVID-19 figures across Europe. The agency has warned that some 500,000 people could die by March of next year unless urgent action is taken to stem the spread of the virus. The WHO believes impending winter season, low vaccination rates, and the faster spreading Delta variant of the virus contribute to the surge. The warning comes as several European nations have posted record caseloads and announced partial or full lockdowns. The International Organization for Migration says the situation still remains tough for migrants stranded on the border between Belarus and Poland. The organization's chief of mission in Belarus says the migrants still have no access to basic living standards, despite an improvement in their conditions. Thousands of migrants have been camping for weeks on the Belarusian side of the border with Poland. They're trying to cross into the European Union, but Poland blocks their entry. Warsaw accuses Minsk of fomenting the crisis, a claim Belarus denies. Minsk started repatriating some of the migrants to Iraq on Thursday. A new German government is taking shape, with the incoming Chancellor Olaf Scholz promising equal number of women and men in his cabinet. A coalition of center-left Social Democrats, Greens, and fiscally conservative Free Democrats is holding talks on selecting new cabinet members. Coalition officials say an agreement on portfolio distribution is likely to be reached in the coming week. Scholz is set to nominate three women from his own party for cabinet posts, including incumbent Environment Minister Svenja Schulz to run the Economy Ministry. The incumbent Labour Minister is also set to keep his job due to his strong performance during the pandemic. Social Democrats narrowly won the federal election in September by beating Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives. Now, the UK's move to label Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist organization is drawing widespread condemnation. Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measure at Israel's behest. It says the designation is an unjustified aggression against the Palestinian people and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Hamas has also condemned the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has also condemned Britain's decision. Iran has denounced the British measure as well. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. The UK decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing.
The UK government has announced plans to declare the entirety of Hamas as a terrorist organisation. In a move led by Home Secretary Priti Patel, supporters of the group could face up to 14 years in jail under plans announced on Friday.
Previously, it was just the armed wing of the Palestinian organization, which had been prescribed under the Terrorism Act 2000. However, the new ban will also include the political wing of the group, which currently serves as the democratically elected government in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Following the announcement, criticism came in thick and fast online. Patel's close relationship with Israel was one of the main points raised.
It's not really a surprise, considering where this proscribing is coming from. Look at the UK. Look at the UK. It's an imperial power that refuses to acknowledge the damage caused by its empire's past. You know, how many countries have had to struggle against the United Kingdom for their own independence? So it's no shock that this proscribing statement is coming from the UK government, and it's no shock that it's coming from this current Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who, do not forget, once tried to give international aid money to Israel's army.
Why such a thing will happen? And the only sort of explanation is, when you look at the Home Secretary's history, that she actually undermines the procedures and policies of British government, her own government, her own country, and had a secret meetings with the then Prime Minister Netanyahu, and she was removed because of that. So she has actually shown she's more willing to do things against British interests and in British policy in support of the State of Israel.
Israel welcomed the move as a significant decision, while Hamas accused the UK of supporting the aggressors at the expense of the victims. But the move would require approval by Parliament first. A prescription order has been introduced, with debates and a vote expected to follow. If passed, the law will come into force on November the 26th. Robert Carter, London.
The Yemeni army has announced a large-scale military operation deep into Saudi territory in response to the kingdom's escalating attacks against the impoverished country. The Yemeni army spokesman says 14 drones were used in the retaliatory attack against targets across Saudi Arabia. Yahya Sari said the King Khalid Air Base, or base that is, was struck in Riyadh, while King Abdullah International Airport and Aramco oil facilities were targeted in Jeddah. He added that military targets were also hit in the kingdoms of Abha, Jizan, and Najran regions. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition said it has carried out a major offensive in Yemen, targeting 13 areas in Sana'a, Sa'da, and the Ma'arib. Saudi Arabia has recently wrapped up its war on Yemen, which it launched back in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed, and millions more displaced since then. Yemeni activist and political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti earlier joined us from Sana'a to discuss the latest retaliatory operation by Yemeni forces. He believes that more such attacks can put an end to the Saudi war on Yemen.
To show you that the Yemeni army has actually carried out attacks that have reached most of the Saudi land. That's why I think that this latest attack, it will, if we continue, if Sana'a continue this type of attack, I think that the war will come to an end. But if we continue to target after Saudi continuous attack and blockade on Yemen, I think that the Saudi actually will continue their war. That's why Yemeni army should keep targeting Saudi Arabia, and I think they must at this point repeat the attack against Aramco oil field like they did 2 or 3 years ago against Baqiq and Khurais in Saudi Arabia. Because if we have seen how many times those airports, especially Abha and Najran and Jizan, has come under Yemeni attack, but still Saudi still actually did not stop its war against Yemen. That's why many lives are lost every day, not only by the Saudi airstrike, but as well by the Saudi blockade, which has been tightened more since Biden has reached the White House. And I believe that Yemeni army is capable not only to launch 14 drones at once. I'm sure that in the coming days or weeks, we're going to see some strategic attack against Saudi Arabia involving tens or 20 to 50 drones and ballistic missiles.
Chile will hold general elections on Sunday to choose the country's next president, lawmakers, and regional council members. Nearly 15 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Seven candidates are vying for the presidency, with recent opinion polls showing two frontrunners. One is Gabriel Boric, a congressman who represents the left-wing coalition and was a leader of the student movement. Another main contender is Jose Antonio Kast from the far-right Christian Social Front Coalition. He's a lawyer and former congressman. A runoff will be held on December 9th if none of the candidates obtains an outright majority. Voters will also elect all 155 members of the lower house of Congress, 27 of 50 senators and regional council representatives. A U.S. court has acquitted a militia member of murder in the killing of two men during last year's protests against police brutality. The acquittal of the white teenager is causing mixed reactions. While some groups and politicians welcome the verdict, others see it as a failure of the already broken justice system. The case is drawing national attention because It arises from the Black Lives Matter protests sweeping the U.S. last year.
Justice system in the U.S. in the spotlight after a Wisconsin court cleared homicide charges against white teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. He was in court over his fatal shooting of two men and injuring another during anti-racism protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August 2020. The court ruled that Rittenhouse had acted in self-defense. It rejected the argument of prosecutors accusing the 18-year-old of provoking violence during the Kenosha rallies. Gun rights supporters welcomed the verdict too. Former President Donald Trump also congratulated Rittenhouse and defended the shooting as self-defense. Republican lawmakers were happy too, with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson saying justice has been served. But others do not think so. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, a Democrat, believes to call the verdict a miscarriage of justice is an understatement, and the victims' friends say they are sad about what the system has done. Several civil rights and racial justice groups denounced the verdict as a travesty. The American Civil Liberties Union says the trial highlights an urgent need for reforms to both police and the legal system. And gun control advocates warn the verdict could inspire a new wave of armed vigilantism. President Joe Biden, reacting to the verdict, says it leaves many Americans, including himself, feeling angry and concerned. But the jury has spoken. Biden wants everybody to be peaceful as people fill the streets across the U.S. to protest what they see as the failure of the justice system. Commentator Kyla Papuche says Rittenhouse's case shows increasing polarization in the U.S. and eroding trust in the government there. Rittenhouse's also reignited debate about gun rights and the boundaries of self-defense in the U.S. As critics remain unconvinced and people are on the streets, the standoff over the American gun culture, racism, and vigilantism appears far from over.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Documents provided exclusively to the Grey Zone website detail Canberra's abandonment of Julian Assange, an Australian citizen, and provide shocking details of his prison suffering. Stay with us for part one of a two-part article written by Kit Clarenberg, an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. The piece is titled, New Files Expose Australian Government's Betrayal of Julian Assange and Detail His Prison Torment. Was the government of Australia aware of the US Central Intelligence Agency's plot to assassinate Julian Assange, an Australian citizen and journalist, arrested and now imprisoned under unrelenting, bleak, harsh conditions in the United Kingdom? Why have the country's elected leaders refused to publicly advocate for one of its citizens, who, according to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Meltzer, has been held on dubious charges and subjected to torture by a foreign power? What does Canberra know about Julian Assange's fate, and when did it know it? The Grey Zone website has obtained documents revealing that the Australian government has since day one been well aware of Julian Assange's cruel treatment inside London's maximum security prison at Belmarsh, and has done little or nothing about it. In fact, it has turned a cold shoulder to the jailed journalist, despite hearing his testimony of conditions so bad that his mind was shutting down. Not only has Canberra failed to effectively challenge the American and British governments overseeing Julian Assange's imprisonment and prosecution, as these documents expose in stark detail, it appears to have colluded with them in the flagrant violation of an Australian citizen's human rights, while doing its best to obscure the reality of his situation from the public. In the wake of Yahoo News' startling September revelations of CIA plans to survey, kidnap, and even kill Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, which confirmed and built up a May 2020 expose by the Grey Zone's Max Blumenthal, officials in the NATO-orientated Five Eyes global spying network struggled to get their stories straight. William Evanina, Washington's top counterintelligence officer until his retirement in early 2021, told Yahoo News the Five Eyes alliance was critical to Langley's dastardly plot, and we were very confident that Julian Assange's potential escape from the Ecuadorian embassy in London could be prevented by hook or by crook. However, when asked whether the United States had ever briefed or consulted the government of Julian's native Australia on the operation, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade dodged the question. For his part, Malcolm Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister at the time of those deadly deliberations, claimed, "The first I heard about this was in today's media." Elected officials in Canberra claimed that they were kept in the dark about the CIA's proposals. Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam said he was unaware of the very existence of Five Eyes until 1973, 17 years after his country became a signatory to the network's underpinning UK-USA agreement. Following police raids on the offices of domestic spying agency, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, due to its withholding of information from the government. Whether or not Malcolm Turnbull was aware of the operation, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade's response when a member of Julian Assange's family contacted the department demanding Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne ask the Biden administration to drop the charges against him and seeking comment on the Yahoo article was disturbingly flippant. A Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade official quipped in a classic non-denial denial, "Just because it's written in a newspaper doesn't mean it's true. The CIA has been accused of a lot of things, including faking the moon landing." These crude remarks were recorded in a letter sent to Maurice Payne by John Shipton, Julian Assange's father. The missive is just one of many documents provided exclusively to Grey Zone by Kelly Tranter, Julian Assange's legal authority in Australia. For years, Kelly Tranter has filed Freedom of Information requests with the Australian government in a campaign to uncover his true position on Julian, and to what extent his intimate alliance with Washington has limited its ability or willingness to push for his freedom. The documents acquired by Kelly Tranter exposed Canberra as anything but an advocate for Julian Assange, an Australian citizen. Instead, throughout Julian Assange's time in the Ecuadorian embassy and imprisonment at Her Majesty's pleasure in Belmarsh High Security Prison, Britain's Guantanamo, the Australian government has been determinedly committed to seeing, hearing and speaking no evil in this regard. Despite possessing clear evidence of his dramatically waning physical and mental health and the torturous conditions of his confinement. The records of a brief visit by Australian consulate officers to Belmarsh Prison on 17th of May 2019, 1 month after Assange's dramatic expulsion from the Ecuadorian embassy, are especially illustrative of Canberra's attitude. Over the course of that meeting, Julian Assange spoke in detail about prison conditions and his 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement. The Australian consular officials noted he remains in his cell most of the day with 40 minutes allocated each day for associations, adding he's allowed outside for 30 minutes each day, although he said at times this does not happen for reasons unstated. Unable to eat at all for a long period, he was now ingesting small amounts, collecting meals from the kitchen and returning to his cell. Permitted just 2 personal visits each month plus legal consultations, Julian Assange mentioned his recent meetings with Niels Meltzer and 2 medical experts specialized in examining potential victims of torture and other ill treatment, and that he had so far been unable to speak to his family. According to the diplomats, the WikiLeaks co-founder eschewed work programs which could afford him the opportunity to get out of his cell more often, on the grounds that he refused to engage in slave labor and needed time to prepare his legal case. Prisoners in British jails earn an average of $13 per week for hard, thankless toil on behalf of big business, which in turn profits immensely from their rank exploitation. While mercifully prescribed antibiotics and codeine by prison doctors for an infected root canal, which can be life-threatening in the event the infection spreads, Julian Assange was still waiting on reading glasses and had yet to see an optometrist. Adding to his psychological toll, Assange reported that he had undergone blood tests and been advised he was HIV positive, a shocking diagnosis. However, subsequent examinations confirmed the test result to be a false positive, forcing Assange to wonder if the misdiagnosis was a mere error or something else. It could well have been a grotesquely sick mind game, perhaps alluding to the bogus sexual assault allegations he had faced in Sweden and intended to drive him towards madness. Assange also presented the Australian consular officials with a recently published UK Home Office deportation notice, informing him then Secretary of State Sajid Javid had determined under the 1971 UK Immigration Act that his presence in the United Kingdom was not conducive to the public interest, and he will be removed from the United Kingdom without delay, with no chance of appealing the decision. The officer wrote, Mr. Assange expressed concern about surviving the current process and fears he would die if taken to the United States. He said the U.S. was going through his possessions that had remained at the Ecuadorian embassy. He said that this action was illegal. Adding, he stated that his possessions included 2 valuable artworks he planned to sell to raise funds for his legal defense, the manuscripts of 2 books and legal papers. He expressed concern his legal material would be used against him by the United States. Assange was correct that sensitive documents were stolen by U.S. authorities. Immediately following his arrest, his attorney, Gareth Pierce, contacted the Ecuadorian embassy regarding its privileged material, demanding it be handed over as a matter of urgency. When at last his property was collected, all legal papers were missing, save for two volumes of Supreme Court files and a number of pages of loose correspondence, making his extradition defense an even greater challenge than it already was. Over the course of Julian Assange's initial extradition hearings in early 2020, Assistant U.S. Secretary for the Eastern District of Virginia, Gordon Cromberg, implausibly pledged a taint team would exercise material from these files so it would not be used in any resultant trial. Similarly, feeble assurances of this ilk were offered during the recent appeal proceedings. Despite his situation, Julian Assange somehow retained a vague shred of optimism about the future in discussions with consular officials, suggesting that the result of Australia's federal election, which was held the very next day, may present a window for a new government to do something supportive for his case, asking that Foreign Minister Maurice Payne be briefed on developments. As it was, Scott Morrison's Liberal National Coalition retained its grip on power, and no alarm was publicly raised about anything learned over the course of the consular visit. Indeed, remaining tight-lipped on Julian Assange's suffering, no matter how horrendous, was to be a matter of dedicated policy. Well, dear listeners, that was the first part of Kit Clarenberg's article, New Files Expose Australian Government's Betrayal of Julian Assange and Detail His Prison Torment. Tune in tomorrow for the second part of this two-part article.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us ponder a wise aphorism from Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Worship is not the quantity of prayer and fasting. It's how much you think of your God.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being religious. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about being religious in the Islamic lifestyle. What does it mean? In the Islamic lifestyle, being religious means that we do not disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because He is the creator. And when we talk about the Islam, Islam is the complete religion which was sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this Islam is which will take us towards the perfection. So therefore, being religious means in Islamic context that you do not disobey Allah. You obey to His orders, and wherever there is a disobedience, you get away from that place. You do not go near to the place where there is a disobedience, because in the disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is a sin. Obviously, we get rewards for our good deeds, and the people will get punishment for their bad deeds. Therefore, we need to decide whether are we gonna be from the good people or the bad people. If we think that we will be from the good people, then we need to think what should we do in order to become a good person. So a good person is when he is beneficial for the society, when he is beneficial for his households, when he is beneficial for the community where he lives. And this is what Islam tells us. Being religious means be the beneficial, the most beneficial for your society, for the public, for the community where you live, for your neighbors, for your workmates, for your college mates or the schoolmates, anywhere where you live. Obviously, you need to be beneficial. That's what being religious means, because when you're religious, you observe the justice.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being religious, and we said being religious means you live according to justice. You are a just person because it is the religious person who observes the justice, because when he is not disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously he is being just and he observes justice. Why? Because the Lord that he prays, the God that he worships, who is Allah Almighty, that Allah is just, and even the rules that he has sent for us, the lifestyle that he set to us to observe is according to justice. So when we talk about the person being religious, it means that he does not waste his time. A religious person in his Islamic lifestyle does not waste his time. He does not go for haram or forbidden things. Even if he wants entertainment, he gets entertainment through the halal means. If he has a lust, he goes for that through the halal means. Allah has made marriage halal and adultery haram. So basically, and also on top of that, Allah has made man responsible for the woman. So he said, rather than having a relationship as a girlfriend or boyfriend, you guys should marry each other. So when you marry each other, then you will observe the halal means. Obviously, you follow the halal way of enjoying your life, having a spouse, having someone who is next to you with whom you can share, and this partner that you have, this partner will live with you, with your responsibility. So both parties have responsibility. Even when we talk about the meat, obviously Allah said that if you want to eat meat, it should be through halal means, which means that it should be slaughtered in the Islamic way. So in all the aspects of life, we can see Allah has just said us that being religious means to not to disobey him, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Yuji is 11 months old and has become an internet sensation after a video of her snowboarding went viral in China. Wang Yuji is a daredevil infant snowboarder whose adorable face sticks out from underneath all of the protective snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby in the fun of snow sports. While snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk, Yuji wasn't scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports. Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that they can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere, from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year, the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. The Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones, and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period, as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting, with holiday-themed and full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to like now like go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah,
definitely after the what year and a half that we've had.
Yeah,
so.
And it's really nice to see everything up close because it's like you see in a photo, but then it's more real and real. So
yeah.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
From a gray and gloomy look to a cheery and colorful appearance. That's a story of how a neighborhood in Peru's capital, Lima, is being transformed to become a tourist attraction. A group of artists in Lima are bringing color and joy to this hilly neighborhood by painting the walls of houses. Creating an optical illusion of a giant mural, the project is visible from different spots across the city. The designers are hoping what they did can improve the lives of residents in a neighborhood that was considered to be unsafe before.
What we are doing here is communal work with all the neighbors, and we are doing it because it's important to change the environment through the use of colors. This hill was considered an unsafe and dangerous area of the city, so we decided to change that social stigma through art, which for me as a muralist is the best tool to achieve it.
The project was started 5 months ago, and workers are now putting the final touches to their work of art. The mural covers over 300,000 square meters. It's the largest in South America.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The birth of a baby sloth at an uncharacteristically hasty speed has surprised London zookeepers. A tiny two-toed sloth named Terry was born to a mother, Marilyn, at the weekend. The zookeepers say there was no sign at all that Marilyn was going into labor when they checked her in the morning. However, less than an hour, they spotted something like a tiny arm tucked into her tummy. Marilyn had quietly delivered the baby with no fuss at all while her keepers were chopping up sweet potatoes for her breakfast. The mother and baby are said to be doing well, but the zookeepers still don't know the sex of the baby.
Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mesa X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgeries.
Guide valves in the vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter. Yeah. This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
A tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to 4 cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The 4 were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on,
they are in good health. That is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Here's what you can call killing two birds with one stone. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbuk Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
Often it does not take much to bring about positive social change. In Johannesburg, a group of painters are creating artworks on the trolleys of street recyclers. Reason? To encourage bystanders to look up and notice the work recyclers, locally known as reclaimers, do in the community.
I like my work to have meaning, so when I get to paint and become a part of a project like this, it's great for me, you know, because it's not every day we get to like do stuff like this, so yeah.
Up until now, they were just filthy-looking jumbo bags with recyclable waste wheeling along the streets. But thanks to graffiti artists who are giving them a makeover with bold and bright designs to help identify and protect the recyclers, artists say their goal is to build a relationship between neighborhood residents and waste pickers. The reclaimers roam around the city day and night, with some motorists even considering them a risk as the trolleys are not always visible. There are some 6,000 reclaimers in Johannesburg who make a living collecting, sorting, recycling garbage. It's a messy job, but they do it anyway. A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats, but here we're witness to the birth of forests as well, and that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning.